so quiet this afternoon. Just the breeze. I must say, the world is testing the stability of our sesshin, a bit discombobulating, and I just such an interesting mix of different parts of life all coming together in sesshin, as is always the case. And like I say, for me, that kind of music, you know, this is like Grateful Dead cover band. It was indeed the China Cats, or most of the members, I think. It was probably volunteer friends, because it's, I think, like a fundraiser for the school. The lead guitarist said he's the dad of one of the kids here. And I've seen them quite a few times, actually, around Santa Cruz. And usually with, you know, 100 or so people totally engaged in a sea of dancing enthusiasm in front of them, feeding their energy. And I have to confess that during the break, my body was drawn over there. I thought, is there something in the sesshin guidelines about this? Technically not, right? Dancing to live music. It's in the park, yeah, it's in the boundaries.
What would Fuyo Donko say about that?
Yes, the eyes of the ancient ancestors are scowling at me. I feel them.
They might be dancing along with you.
Maybe, yeah. I went, my body starts moving when I hear that kind of music. It's in my alaya or something. And there were just a couple people dancing over there, one of which I just met at the Zen Center like a week ago. He'd come by here. A couple of deadheads. Just a few. And like, it was all these, food stands and parents and kids hanging out. They had all these chairs up in front, and hardly anyone was there. Maybe some families and band or something. And I thought, wow, they're like really, really like putting out this musical energy and basically kind of ignored. Maybe it's a certain like kind of culture that's wow, and it's the background entertainment or something. So I went up to them between songs and said, you guys seem really like underappreciated today. And they said, well, actually, we really appreciate each other. And it felt that way, that, you know, they're just having a lot of fun playing music together.
You should tell them there were people over here listening.
Yeah, I didn't know how to explain what we're doing. I did tell the person who came to Zen Center, said, "Oh, I'm just reading the Three Pillars of Zen about sesshin, because I kind of want to get more into Zen practice." I'm like, "Yeah, we're right in the middle of sesshin right now." I said, "Really? Is this possible?" I said, "I didn't think so before today." For me, it's almost like a kind of yoga, going to these dance things. It's kind of like when it's live, particularly, and it's loud, and meeting the energy with the movements of this body. There's moments in there of grace where it's like total flow, and laughter spills out of me with the just the joy of union, something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. Sometimes not. And there, yeah, I couldn't help thinking that during our various events, I think they were trying to play a lot of kind of spiritual tunes, old gospel, some of them. I heard them saying on stage, like, talking about various dead songs to play, and like, is this one churchy enough? I think they were conscious of the fact that they were playing at a church event, like, maybe that's pushing it. But the dead played a lot of old folk and kind of gospel type songs. So they were, sometimes during Zazen in the morning, they were playing this song called Sisters and Brothers. Just, you know, old church music, I think, that the Jerry Garcia band would play. And it goes something like, one verse is something like, this world is not our own. We're only passing through. Our treasures all laid up way beyond the blue. Let's do the very best that we can. While we're traveling through this land, we can all be together, shaking a hand when we make it to the promised land. Walk together, little children. You don't ever have to worry. Through this world of trouble, we gotta love one another. Let's take a fellow man by the hand. Try to help him to understand. We will all be together forever and ever when we make it to the promised land.
That was a rough transmission, right?
Steve Stuckey would also appreciate the blues. You know, maybe there's some different understanding of heaven and other traditions, but we're doing this work in this realm, and we can and we will, and I think in our tradition we might say we are together forever and ever in the promised land of Buddha. Yeah, something like that.
They get the same thing.
Yep. So, self-emptiness and other emptiness. I just thought to take the opportunity to mention a little bit more, maybe in a clearer way than I did this morning. I confess it was the sharp clarity of my mind was like hard to maintain during that talk. In Tibetan, they call it rong tong, is self-emptiness, and shen tong is other emptiness. There are important differences between citta matra, meaning mind only, the mind-only school, and Shen Tong. First, Shen Tong does not accept this mind-only view. Some people claim the mind-only view that consciousness is truly existent. They hold the Madhyamaka view, this middle way view, that consciousness or mind is non-arising and without self-nature. They consider themselves to be great Madhyamakas. Sometimes they call it this, great, the great middle way school. because their system involves not only recognizing freedom from all conceptual contrivance, but also the realization of the wisdom mind that is free from all conceptual contrivance. They emphasize not only emptiness, but the wisdom mind that realizes emptiness. That's like this awareness. This non-conceptual wisdom mind is not the object of the conceptualizing process, and so it's not negated by Madhyamaka reasoning of Nagarjuna, so on. Therefore, it can be said to be the only thing that has absolute true existence. Now, this is, you know, there's all kinds of subtlety in these different terms in Sanskrit and Tibetan and so on. So it doesn't mean like, you know, inherent existence, like something solid, tangible, touchable, and real in that way. And yet there's something truly existent in a certain sense. This is what, how you can see how it gets kind of controversial with the teaching of no self. This sounds very much like an Atman, which is like a kind of true essential self that the Buddha denied. So they have to dance on a fine line here, the other emptiness folks. It's important to understand that this true existence does not mean that it can be conceptualized. If it were even the most subtle object of the conceptual process, it could be refuted by this Madhyamaka reasoning. This non-conceptual wisdom mind is not something that even supreme wisdom can take as its object. It can't be like an object of mind. It can't be objectified. Anything that can be an object of consciousness, however pure and refined, is dependently arising and therefore has no independent true existence. I partly present this because I feel like it's very similar to Zen understanding, particularly Keizan's understanding. Sometimes it's even said that Dogen maybe leans a little bit more towards the kind of like self-emptiness side, really more like negation. I don't know. He maybe doesn't really lean in either direction. But compared to Keizan, and Keizan's really emphasizes let go of everything and then you will see this one. There's something, he keeps saying. So I think he's very clearly like an other emptiness practitioner. So what is the non-conceptual wisdom mind? That's what the Zen people are always asking. What is this non-conceptual wisdom mind? And since, you know, Zen people might say this painting was painted by Scholar Wu. Peter, we had a story about Scholar Wu, actually. Painted a picture of Kuan Yin in an earlier story. But in this case, they're not Zen people, so they say, what is the non-conceptual wisdom mind? It is something that one realizes through means other than the conceptual process. One experiences it directly, just as it is. And any conceptual fabrication obscures it. In Tibetan tradition, all the teachings of Mahamudra and Dzogchen and the whole, all the tantras are about this non-conceptual wisdom mind and the means of realizing it. The teacher's realization and the disciple's devotion and openness of mind have to meet in such a way that the disciple can experience that non-conceptual wisdom mind directly. Now that sounds very much like these Zen stories. They they open to it in a meeting. From then on, one uses that experience as the basis of one's practice, nurturing and fostering it until it becomes clear and stable. So it's kind of like an introduction. And maybe we can hear these stories. You know, there's a meeting between two people, something turns, the student has great enlightenment, great awakening. Some people might take that as, then that's the end of their practice, and then like a Buddha, and they're all done. But maybe we can see that more as like, they clearly see now the nature of mind, but maybe just for a glimpse. And then that glimpse is the basis of the practice for nurturing and fostering it until it becomes clear and stable, which it's not at first.
So that you're saying that's the non-conceptual wisdom, right?
Could be. Yeah, for one moment, entering according with the non-conceptual wisdom mind. Yeah. And there's release. There's no the problem maker drops dead for a moment, and there's no inside outsider in between for a moment. Yes.
About the practice, I mean, I can barely, but I can fall, you know, see with clarity these fine points, mm-hmm. these two sides, but I don't see for the actual practice.
Mm, yeah.
Like,
how would you practice differently?
What would be different?
Yeah.
Even in a turning, like an awakening moment, what would be different?
Yeah.
Besides, you know, what it might be called.
Yeah. Mm hmm. In the moment, maybe not so different, but the kind of like maybe even next few moments. This is addressed here in this description. Maybe I'll just skip ahead to that because you get the basic gist. This is sort of about the practice here. This other emptiness contention is that the experience of complete freedom from conceptual contrivance must also be the experience of this clear, light, luminous nature of mind. In their opinion, a Madhyamaka person who denies this, that this exists, must still have some subtle concept which is obscuring or negating this reality. In other words, they have not truly realized complete freedom from conceptual contrivance. This happens because for a long time, the meditator, maybe in meditation, has been cutting through illusion and seeing emptiness as a kind of negation. This becomes such a strong habit that even when the experience of this ultimate truth of the clear, luminous nature of mind starts to break through like the sun from behind the clouds, the meditator, in meditation, automatically turns their mind toward it to subtly negate it. So, there could be that kind of thing happening. And maybe we're not so, maybe we wouldn't have that problem because we're not doing this like hardcore Madhyamaka negation thing in Zazen. We might be though. We might even call that like, you know, cut through all thinking, let go of thought. We might be really like, here comes a thought. And make it into something.
Yeah,
exactly. And something like that, I think, is why the self-emptiness people argue against that that approach, actually. It's so easy to grasp. And I think also a lot of these Zen stories are about that actual thing, is that somebody kind of thinks they got a hold of something, and then the teacher tries to cut through that again. And then if they get into the other kind of like sort of denial, nihilistic side, then they try to bring forth the other side. So it's always this back and forth. Maybe even all these stories in a row that we have about they're about to speak and they get cut off, or maybe kind of this point that they actually do see something and they're about to express it, like, wow, the clear light nature of mind right here. And like, you know, don't say saying it's making it into something already. So it may play out in practice like this, but it may be just kind of like hair splitting philosophical point also. I think the main thing I appreciate about this is that these other emptiness descriptions honor some kind of inconceivable, ungraspable experience. And I think that the Zen teachings do that too. Especially Keizan. But yeah, dangers on all sides. That's why some of these verses of Keizan were like walking on a razor's edge or on thin ice. I think that's pointing to that kind of thing. And you know, for us it might be like, well, I'm not actually like on a razor's edge or thin ice. I'm just like trying to stay awake or something. Or like trying to make friends with the problem maker. So there's that too. And then so there's working with all kinds of different levels with our experience and practice. And I think in these transmission of light stories, they're often talking about something quite subtle, but that doesn't mean something far away or much different from our experience. It's always right here. They're talking about something that is who we are, but we might be like paying attention to other stuff. So if we're ever going to bring up this kind of thing, I think Sesshin's a good place to do it. And it may be somewhat related to, like, I don't know how you all felt, especially those who've been around for a few days of the Sesshin, but I think if this whole musical thing was going on the first day for me, I would have, the problem maker would have gotten much more involved. I think something about it's the fourth day, and it's kind of like, well, I don't know what Sesshin is anyway, just this is what's happening. And it's like completely okay. So I don't know if that's related to this conversation, but maybe in there, like, there's something that's like okay. That doesn't need to be negated or blocked out.
This whole session has been noisy. This Thursday was the hammering.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know about Friday. And then
Friday was the hammering.
Oh, Friday was hammering also, yeah.
Friday was hammering.
Saturday was the mariachi.
Yep. What will it be tomorrow? The weekend's ending, so. Yeah, school at noon, recess tomorrow. We'll hear. Yeah. The world, we create our little refuge, but the world's all around us, but we're only passing through.
And I think of You know, San Francisco, as I said, has this, you know, this historical building made by world famous architect, and they're in a beautiful part of San Francisco, but they're on a big street, and, and you sit there, and you know the light is changing every 30 seconds. Catherine says, you know, that is your life, and here we are.
Yeah.
And we've got a beautiful building, a beautiful part of town.
Yeah. And, you know, if it was always, you know, filled with noise from all sides, that would be hard. But, you know, in the early morning and the late evening, things get are very quiet for the most part. Even right now, they're pretty quiet, actually. So, it's all included. Pure wind circles the earth and shakes it up. But who can pluck up this wind and show it to you? Do we want to make the wind into something? It's light. It illuminates the world, but can't be seen itself. The 47th ancestor was Zen teacher Wu Kung, meaning realizing emptiness. And his other names are Chun Xie Qing Yao, and his Japanese name is Choro Seiryo Daiyosho. He studied with Dangjia, Tangka Shijun. Tangka asked him, "What is the self prior to the empty eon?" And empty eon, they like to bring that phrase up in Zen talks, but it's part of the old Indian Buddhist cosmology of a universe, or like a world system. Has like several kalpas or eons that make it up, and it starts with arising. It has like a phase of like coming into formation. I don't know if modern physics would agree with this exactly, but I think there is some period of formation of like a universe, actually, right? Mm-hmm. I'd say there's a period of formation, like an eon, a long time of formation, then there's a time of kind of abiding. Maybe physics wouldn't agree with it. There's a time of kind of stable abiding. There's different models, right, about the Big Bang, is everything's moving outward, and then one model I've heard is that at some point it starts contracting, turns around. Have you ever heard about that? Maybe the most recent version negates that. But I've heard that's one physics model. The universe is infinite, is expanding in all directions, but it reaches a certain point, and maybe the old Indians would say that point that it reaches is the phase of abiding, and then it starts contracting again, and that's like the eon of like disintegrating. That we're talking about like a whole universe or cosmos, world system, and then at some point. They talk about this raging firestorm at the end of the this eon of destruction of the universe, where the whole thing is kind of burned up, and then there's an empty eon where nothing's happening. Actually, it's between universes. One universe just ended, and the next one hasn't arose yet. It's like, what is that? what would that be? We're not even talking about space, right? Because it's the end of space. Again, I think modern quantum physics gets into some of this kind of territory. People want to know, like, what is this empty eon? But you can imagine how the Zen people picked up on that. Oh, the empty eon, that's when the whole universe hasn't arisen and another one has ceased. In other words, it's completely ungraspable in a universal scale. So Tanka asked Choro Seryo, what is the self prior to the empty eon? A little bit like really the same question as like, what's your original face before your parents were born? But maybe this pushes it a little further from before your parents were born to before the universe came to be. What was yourself then? And you know, these questions are almost kind of generic sounding. We keep hearing them. But if you feel quite settled in Zazen, it can be quite wonderful to like bring up a question like that. Make it personal, not just some intellectual theoretical thing, because it's definitely, it can't be an intellectual theoretical thing. I think that's the point of that kind of question. It's so beyond answering it. But who was I? What is the self? Like, here am I right now, right? All the ideas about myself and who I am. I feel like I've existed for as long as I can remember. But whoever I am, who was I? Truly, who was this one that truly is the self before the empty eon? Or if that seems too mind-boggling, just before my parents were born. Actually, I think it's equally mind-boggling, but... So, it's a big question with no answer, but I think to ask a question like that, I find, for me, it feels like it kind of breaks down the barriers of my limited mind. Especially, you might say, well, I don't have, like, time and energy to, like, deal with questions like that because I'm just, like, trying to keep the problem maker at bay. He's barking at my door. And so, I would say, actually, I think they're closely related. I think if the problem maker, like, why am I doing another day of this sesshin? It's just, like, makes no sense. And I can't even remember what the practice is. And I can't concentrate at all. And everything's annoying me. Then, like, what was that question again? Oh, yeah. What's the self before the empty eon? It could be that if we ask that, you know, really deeply and sincerely, the troublemaker is like, I don't even think we can say the troublemaker is out the window. It's just like, we see that it's almost like, it's like the cosmic joke or something, right? It's like my issues are, seem so insignificant in the face of the self before the empty eon.
Maybe the problem maker is contemplating the same thing.
How so?
Well, in other words, it leaves you alone because it's busy doing, you know, kind of wondering the same thing.
The problem maker is wondering
about what its face was before.
Like that's the problem, you mean?
No, in other words, it's not bugging you because it's off wondering about these same questions.
Oh, you give the problem maker that problem?
Exactly. She's working on
that one. Ah, yeah. That's another way to put it. Mm-hmm. The problem maker's got its problem. And so you say, like, I know these are really big ones that you're working with. You want a really, really big one? Here he goes. Yeah, it's a little, where did we hear that recently? Oh yeah, it was Nishiari Boku-san's Genjo Koan commentary. He said the problem with us people is that we have all these little graspings and self-concerns and stuff. And what we really, you know, if we really want to practice wholeheartedly, we need to get a really, really big grasping. And then that's what we need to do. We need a really, really big problem. Like, what's the self prior to the empty eon? So Tanka asked Seryo, what's the self? Not like the ego self, right? You know, who you really are prior to the empty eon. Seryo started to speak, and Danka, yeah, he didn't put his hand over his mouth, but he said, as he was starting to speak, you're noisy. Before he even started to speak, he said, you're noisy. Go away for a while. So, let us note that in these Zen ancestors between Dongshan up to Dogen, these later Chinese Zen ancestors of the Soto school, three in a row were that we just heard this week. Three of the story of their awakenings were they were about to say something and they got cut off. Then we had one other little slightly different story, and now here's another one where he's about to say something to respond and he gets cut off. Is this like the family style of our tradition? Or is it something, is it really emphasizing something about that words can't reach it? Something about speech and words. He started to speak and Tanka said, you're noisy, go away for a while. One day, Choro climbed Boyu Peak and was suddenly awakened. Kind of funny, too, that he just went away and he went up to some mountain peak and was suddenly awakened. It wasn't like in the conversation. He went away, he followed the instructions. So some later time, took him a while to get up to that peak. Choro Seryo's initiatory ordination name was Chingyao or Seryo, purity complete, and his Buddhist name, his other Dharma name was Cheng Shui. Wu Kung was his title as a Zen teacher. When his mother went to a temple hugging him to her bosom in his baby clothes, he saw an image of the Buddha and raised his eyebrows and blinked in delight as a baby. Everyone thought this was unusual. When he was 17, he lectured on the Lotus Sutra. He became a monk and went to Datsu Temple in Chengdu and Sichuan. There he learned the sutras and treatises and grasped their great meaning. He left Sichuan to go to the area of the Chiang Mien and Han rivers and knocked on Tanka Shijun's door. Tanka asked him, what's the self prior to the empty eon? And later, he was suddenly awakened. When he returned from Poyu Peak and stood before... Oh, he returned at once after his awakening from this mountain peak and stood before Tanka. Tanka slapped him, maybe lightly. I think you know that it exists. It exists. The master, Choro Seryo, joyfully bowed. The next day, Tanka entered the hall and said, the teacher entered the hall and said, the sun illuminating the solitary peaks, green. The moonlight falling on the valley streams is cold. The deep, subtle secret of teacher and disciple must not be lodged in a one-inch heart, or must not be placed in a little heart. The deep, subtle secret of the meeting of teacher and student must not be placed in a little heart. Then he left his teaching seat, and Chö Rosario immediately came and stood before him. He said, "Your talk from the teaching seat today cannot deceive me." Tanka said, "Try to present the meaning of what I said on the seat." Chodo was silent for a while. And Tanka said, "I think that you got a glimpse of that realm." Chodo then left Tanka. Later he traveled to Mount Wutai, went to the capital, crossed the Pian River, and arrived at Mount Chonlu, or Choro, which means tall reeds, where he got his name, Chö Rosario, where he had an audience with Tzu Chao. Once they talked, they were in complete agreement. Tzu Chao had him be the Jisha attendant. A year later, they shared teaching. Pretty soon, Tzu Chao retired, saying he was ill. He asked Chö Rosario to carry on the talks. At the end of 1130, he traveled to Mount Shiming and later was the head of monasteries at Mount Puto, Mount Tianfeng in Taichou, and Mount Shuifeng in Mingzhou. Then he was abbot at Mount Yuang as a result of imperial decree. He subsequently moved to Lungxian Monastery in Wenzhou, and then to a monastery at Mount Qing in Hangzhou. Later he founded the Chungshen Monastery in Gaoning Prefecture by decree of the emperor's mother, Suning. Okay, here's the test now. What was the first monastery you went to? This is the historical archives. So now, if we wanted to kind of like research him a little bit more, we'd have some starting clues. Kazan says, "From the time his mother held him wrapped in baby clothes, he was not one of the herd, but rather stood out. Moreover, when he made up his mind to practice Zen, he made a concentrated effort. Therefore, when he was asked about the self prior to the empty eon, he tried to give an answer. Tanka did not approve, but sent him away for a while. One day he climbed to the top of Poyu Peak. He saw the 10 directions unobstructed and the 4 directions of cardinal points, east, south, north, west, gateless. When the 10 directions appeared right in front of him, he was awakened." So that's Kazan's take on this. As he went to the top of the mountain, saw the vast landscape in 10 directions, and in that vastness was awakened. So I appreciate that Kazan added that in, because we don't really know what happened up there. Because, you know, I think there's this term, nature experience. Is that a term? Heard that? I think it's like, you know, like a spiritual experience in nature, right? Often in the vastness of nature, in the non-human realm. And Patrick, and I know, has told the story before of being on one of these hikes, Zen Center hikes,
Richard
Komar, and being up on the ridge, seeing a vast vista landscape, and feeling that expansive openness. Is that how you would say it?
Yes.
Yeah. And kind of connected too, right? Not separate, connected with the vastness of nature. And I think it's common for people maybe more even in the modern world in America than these old times, because in these old times they lived in mountains anyway. They were kind of always in nature. Now it's maybe more unusual, so it really strikes us.
What's the story in the is it Dogen's Avid Streams, Color of the Mountain? The student was listening to a talk, and then later on in a walk, he's awakened in nature.
Yeah, at night. Yeah, the sound of the valley stream, the Buddha's long, broad tongue, the colors of the mountain are the pure body of Buddha. At night, 10,000 sutra verses were recited. The next morning, how can I explain?
Dogen's discussion is, what happened? Was he inspired by the teacher's words? Is this a question that Choryu, Seryu just kept with him and it came to fruition?
Could be.
Mountaintop.
It sounds like the story makes it sound like they're related, yeah? Like they're related events, even though they happened at different times. What's the self prior to the empty eon? You're a little bit noisy. Go away. In fact, I might recommend that you go up to the top of a high mountain where it's very quiet and there's just the wind, and then ask this question again to yourself. Could be like that. Maybe the whole way he's climbing up the mountain. What's the self prior to the empty eon? What's the self prior to the empty eon? And then suddenly, the mountain peak, vastness in all directions, beyond words. The world, still the world, but the big world. Have you all had times in nature, like, where you feel really connected like that? For me, various times, I can think of various times for myself that really feeling that awe. One of them was, I think it was the first time I went to the Sierra Nevada, big snow mountains. First time I maybe ever actually been in like big snow mountains like that. Because I already living at Tassajara, which is mountains, but it's different, you know. If you've been to Tassajara and then the Sierras, the scale is like completely different. Yeah, it's like, wow, Tassajara mountains are like actually little hills. And I was with my brother, and we had a little camping trip and morning hiking up. I remember it's like up above the tree line, and it's all like the granite shale, is it? Or scree, right? It's hard to walk up. It's kind of steep, and it's like this size, all broken up, millions of, you know, for hundreds and hundreds of yards, just made up of these rocks, and no plants or anything. And you can't really see, you're in some kind of crevice or something coming up, so we didn't have a view. We're just like, let's go to the top of that peak. And going up, and the sound of the scree falling down the hillside, it's all like scraping and very like sound. I remember saying to my brother, like, listen to that sound, isn't that something? He's like, whoa, thank you for mentioning, I didn't even notice. Yeah, it's like echoing this rock on rock, so crisp, clear air, you know. So already it's like, and the air is thinner maybe. I don't know if it's that thin in the Sierras, but it's fresh. It is thinner?
I mean, you need to have more hemoglobin to breathe properly.
Maybe on the higher peaks, yeah. I forget, what's the height of...
7,000 feet.
7,000, yeah.
You have to change your recipes.
Yeah.
You use as much baking powder.
And drink a lot of water. And so maybe that's all part of it too. Feeling lightheaded. And I just remember getting to the top of this peak, and then it was like that suddenly, like way down below us, right? All these snow covered, this is in August in the middle of summer, all these snow covered mountains in the middle of summer that we hadn't seen before, and kind of down below, and as far as you can see in all directions, and just speechless, overwhelmed with vastness.
A jeweler's loop does the similar
thing. A jeweler's loop?
It's a magnification thing, like 10 times or 20 times, and you look at anything, a leaf, a flower, a lichen on a rock, and children have this. You can tell they can see that their eyes work.
Whoa. It's a scale thing, yeah?
You see so much more.
A whole world.
Thought was there.
Yeah. Our worlds are there. This is so not only around you, but also beneath your feet or in a drop of water. Our worlds are there through the magnifying glass. Yeah, or those, you can see those, there's books, but I think I've seen like a video now somewhere on the web of like that skit, like that kind of, magic camera kind of thing of, from something like going from a molecule and kind of zooming out bigger and bigger. It's a molecule in a drop of water or something. Drop of water is in a pool, going out and out to the town, up and up into space beyond the planet, and you know, going from the tiny, tiny to the big, big. Kids would love that too, I think, yeah. And that we, our scale, our usual scale is like this kind of sort of random place in the middle of this vast kind of boundless expanse of, you know, you could go even smaller, but we don't have instruments to measure, and you could go even bigger, but we don't have instruments to measure. Our instruments are measuring further in both directions, but something about, and I think maybe one with these nature things, maybe one theory I've had about it is why this happens is I think it's something about us. It's about like this limited sense of who we are and our usual scale, and we're moving around buildings and things, and it's us, and particularly this body, you know, this 5 to 6 foot tall body is this very particular size, and when you put this body in that kind of a landscape, the sense of self that is kind of connected with the body is seen differently. Maybe like that, yeah. We feel very small in the vast landscape, and that feeling very small is that, you know, me feeling very small, I think is kind of like awakening, these awakening stories, like the insignificance of oneself. And again, like the problem maker, right? And it could be going up the mountain. Oh, it's so tired. We're going to have to walk all the way down again. And then they get to the top and like, not an issue. It will be later probably, but right now, it's not an issue. Saw the 10 directions unobstructed, and north, south, east, west, gateless. When the 10 directions appeared right in front of him, he was awakened. He returned and stood before Tanka without saying a word. Tanka realized that he knew it existed and said, "I think you know it exists." It's a little bit like this Tibetan text, right? There's something that truly exists. Ooh, hurts the Madhyamaka ears. Something exists, truly exists, but not in any conceptually graspable way. Then Qing Liao joyfully bowed. Anka finally entered the hall the next day and acknowledged the awakening, this verse. Later, when he appeared as a teacher, Chodo Seyo said, "When I was slapped by my former teacher, my cleverness disappeared. And when I tried to open my mouth, I couldn't." This slap happened after his awakening, right? He came back. The master slapped him and said, "I think you know it exists." And he joyfully bowed, but didn't say anything. So, "I came down from the mountain, was slapped, and my cleverness disappeared. And when I tried to open my mouth, I couldn't. Is there anyone here who has not completely experienced such joy as not being able to say anything? The joy of being speechless. If you're lucky and do not have a bit in your mouths, or a saddle on your backs, you must each apply yourselves to the means of awakening." This is Keizan saying this. You must each apply yourselves to the means of awakening. And each apply yourselves. Interesting phrase, picture like. It might mean like, if you're lucky enough to not be like caught up like a slave horse in this life, to be like, a slave job or something. You have a bit forced in your mouth and a saddle on your back, like you kind of. But it might mean, in practical terms, or it might mean like in spiritual practice terms of like you're making this great struggle in practice, right? We put the bit in our own mouth and the saddle on our own back. And someone, a busy one, is riding our back. A monkey's riding our back. And so he said, if you're lucky and don't have a bit in your mouth or a saddle on your back, then apply yourself to the means of awakening. We might say, well, if we happen to have a bit in our mouth and a saddle on our back, still apply ourselves to the means of awakening, right? And maybe we start with checking out the bit and the saddle, first of all. What is this thing in here? I can't quite breathe right. Who put this hair? Why don't I just take it off? Is it okay? Nobody said no. Okay. I can breathe and chew. But my sweaty back, this heavy saddle, I guess the rider put it on there. I should ask him if I could take it off. Actually, there's no rider, though. Oh, yeah, I put it on here for the rider, but the rider doesn't even care, so. There's other Zen phrases similar to this too, like involving horses in the Blue Cliff record. I think maybe even several times, the commentators saying like, I forget if it's practice instructions or a description of the release of letting go, but he says stripping off the blinders of the horse where it can't see on the side, stripping off the blinders and releasing the saddlebags. These are all great images, right? Or we're hiking up Mount Poyu with a big heavy backpack. And you know how that is, your shoulders and all, it's kind of like, and maybe you've had this experience. I was thinking on the way up you take it off, but sometimes, you know, I know this experience of when maybe you get to the top and you this weight, and when you take it off, you almost feel like you're floating, yeah? You're floating upwards, you're so light. And you walk around like that, and for maybe a few minutes, walking around is like floating. And then, of course, we're usually like that anyway, so we just readjust to the weightless normality, and it's not so refreshing anymore. But just letting go of all these saddlebags full of stuff we're carrying around. When the ancestral teachers see eye to eye, they walk in this realm prior to the empty eon and immediately illuminate the scenery of this fundamental realm. If you cannot see this realm yet, then even if you sit in zazen, speechless for 1,000 or 10,000 years, immobile as a withered tree, like dead ashes, what's the use? Keizan likes to do this kind of thing too. He's talking to all these sincere zazen practitioners. So if you just sit there silent and speechless, what's the use? However, when people hear of prior to the empty eon, they mistakenly think that there is no self, no other, no before or after, no origination or extinction, no sentient beings or Buddhas. It cannot be called one or two. It cannot be discerned as identical or different. So isn't it funny? Keizan himself often talks this way, right? That's the kind of realm it is. But he says, when people hear prior to the empty eon, they mistakenly think this way. Constantly contradicting himself. This has to be okay. Scheming and plotting like this, saying, you know, it's not this and it's not that, maybe just means any kind of like all our ideas about not this and not that. Scheming and plotting like this, thinking that if one utters a single word, one distances oneself from it, or that if a single thought arises, one turns one's back on it, is being like a corpse harboring ghosts as dead as withered trees. So here he's saying, if we think that it's the place of no words and not a single thought arising, that's like harboring ghosts. And then one thinks that anything they do is all right. Oh no, this is the other kind of person. So he's saying, one type of person says, it's not like this, it's not like that, it's beyond all of this. Just sit without a single word or thought. Some people are like that when they hear about prior to the empty eon, and this is kind of like harboring ghosts and withered trees. Or other people think that anything they do is alright. They may think, you can speak of mountains. Mountains are it. Rivers. Self. Other. You can say whatever. Or they think, you can say it's a mountain, but it's not a mountain. You can call it a river, but it's not a river. Only this is a mountain. Only that's a river. All these things in quotes. You can say, but what's the use of saying such things? Keizan says, they all end up on the wrong path. So these people either become attached to form or they fall into the view of nihilists. That's what he's saying. He doesn't leave much choice for any alternatives. How can you locate this realm in either being or non-being? There's no chance to poke in your tongue. No chance to spin your thoughts. It does not depend on heaven a bit, nor on earth, and it does not depend on before and after. Notice where there's no place to take a step right beneath you, and you may have some slight awareness of it. So that sounds like his instruction here, his central instruction. Notice where there is no place to take a step right beneath you. When you're walking, there's no place to take a step right beneath you. So in your present experience with great awareness, your next step, notice how there's no place to take the step beneath you, and you may have some slight awareness of it. Yeah, you might say, oh, it doesn't sound so different than the things he's saying not to do beforehand, but he is making it a little bit more direct and I would say non-theoretical.
So is it just that there is only the present step?
You might say that, but he's saying it more like there's no place to step here, but then step anyway. Then we could call it the present step, or we could call it no place to step. And there again, if we fall into it's just this step, then we might get stuck in form. And if we fall into there's no place to step, we might fall into nihilism. So I think it's beyond all our ideas of this. Just watch how we can't actually get a hold of what's happening with each moment.
Okay, and the Chogram uses the term groundlessness.
Groundlessness. Ground. It sounded that emptiness side, would you say?
Yeah.
Yeah. It does sound like it's... Yeah. Notice that there is no place to take a step right beneath you. So maybe that's... And you might have some slight awareness of it. So maybe you could see it as the union, if we wanted to play with this. Say that there's no step right beneath you. So there's this... We're looking right beneath us, this particular place, and there's no step. Maybe that's the union. Just this, like Jane says, just this step, there's no place to step together. And you know, maybe some of, since it's quite subtle here, maybe some gets lost in translation. Or, he's just talking, right? And he's saying, they'll get stuck in this side or this side, but then like, what do we do? Well, it's, you know, something practical. Take a step. Yeah. Some say that it transcends models. Some say it's beyond calculation. All this is scheming and turning away from the true self. Even more so if you say it is moon, clouds, water, or wind, all in quotes, all the things that he himself says. All these people, unfortunately, have cataracts in their eyes, seeing flowers in the sky where there are none. What do they mean by mountains? Ultimately, they do not see a single thing. What can be felt as cold or warm? Ultimately, not a single thing is imparted to them. Therefore, they cling to trees and grass like ghosts. If they sweep away the way of the world and the Buddha Dharma at the same time, then if they look, they will not doubt. So there's another maybe little instruction. Sweep away the world and all our, the things of our experience, and sweep away Buddha Dharma and all these teachings of Kazan and emptiness stuff. Sweep it all away. Sweep away both sides and all ideas of both sides. Of course, everything, you know, blah, 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 everything I can possibly say is, Kazan would say, you know, you think you can say it like that? And we could say the same to him, right? We could say, well, no, we can't. But still, like, this Manjushri was made by Sally. And nothing, and that doesn't defile the Buddhas to say so. Do not look within. Do not look outside. Do not try to quiet thought. Do not try to calm your bodies. Just know intimately and understand intimately. Cut off discrimination at once and try to do zazen a little. Even though it is said that there is no place in the four directions to take a step and no place in heaven and earth to place your body, in reality, you will not need to get power from elsewhere. When you see it like this, no skin, flesh, bones, and marrow are distributed to you. The coming and going of birth and death do not change you. When you totally shed your skin, there is only the single reality remaining. It lights up past and present and transcends time and space. How can it be called simply prior to the empty eon? This realm is not something that can be said to be before or after. The reason is that this realm is not affected by the four eons of formation, abiding existence, destruction, and nothingness. Can self and others be considered causeless? When you forget the external world and rid yourself of conditioning notions in your head, still the sky receives a blow and you become utterly stripped and exposed. It's the quote, the sky receives a blow, or like we chant at noon, like a hammer striking emptiness. Maybe it's like that. If you see it carefully, being like the sky, it's mysterious. Being empty, it's subtle. If you're not thorough, you will ultimately not reach this place. Clearing up that which has persisted through countless eons occurs in the snap of your fingers. Though it's momentary and brief, without any feeling of indecision, not showing any sign of intellection, try to suddenly cast your eyes on its face, and you will become independent, liberated, and free. However, students, by turning your thoughts in the wrong direction, you've already started the wrong direction. Though you think that this is an extremely minute deviation, you should realize that if you do this, you will not find rest for 1,000 lives and 10,000 eons. He likes the 10,000 eons thing, right? He's like, he's got that one as is in almost every chapter now. Try to think about this carefully and reach this realm without relying on anything else. Completely clear, you'll be like the sky when you're awake. Very similar flavor, huh? Chapter after chapter. Yeah. Pushing us a little, and I think maybe you have a sense, I have some sense that, like, since he keeps calling it this thing and this realm, it's a little like a trick. He's a little bit like holding out some bait to see if we bite. Any thoughts, any comments or questions about Kazan stories, or even completely unrelated? Like, you might feel like, what's with this guy anyway? what's he actually talking about? Or is this helpful? Or what is this practice in our Sashin time remaining?
Is that ancestors into studying in great detail.
Yeah.
And you have to some of the icons of
it's true.
And she's on Lily's painting and showing us how they do have family style, and it could also be just Kazan's especially when the first half of the book, of course, is about the Indian ancestors, but that before really the upheaval.
Especially since these stories, the core case stories, are very short and simple, actually, and concise. And then Kazan does a long commentary, always coming back to this realm. I mean, actually, this story, the original Chinese story, did have this thing of, like, I think you know it exists. So it does have this kind of something existing part in the original Chinese. But it's true. The flavor of all of these ancestral stories is particularly spiced by Kazan.
And we're learning all about Kazan.
Yes.
And, who is one of the icons of,
mm-hmm.
of our
family. Yeah. And a little different, maybe you get the sense hearing this if you studied Dogen some, it's kind of different, a little different style. Same family, right? A little different style from Dogen, especially this kind of, he's kind of forceful, don't you think? It's like if you, it's kind of a classical Zen thing. If you think you can get it this way, nah, forget it. That way, forget it. Just have to not do anything that you're doing now. And just see directly. Dogen hardly ever talks that way. Maybe sometimes, but I think Dogen's more subtle, less forceful, and more like, I think Dogen's, today I would say Dogen is a little bit more non-dual, I think, in that he's like, it's really right here, don't make the slightest effort outside yourself. I mean, Kazan, I think, would agree with that too, but he's Kazan seems to be putting out some more bait. Dogen doesn't put out bait too much. Do you know what I mean by bait? Like, if you can reach this realm, then you will be free forever. Dogen says, like, Dharma is already correctly transmitted. You are immediately your original self. That kind of style. The backward step, turning the light, shining back.
It's much less dramatic.
Yeah, less dramatic, very subtle, and shining back on what already is. Body and mind of themselves will drop away. It sounds effortless. Maybe that's part of it. Dogen, although sometimes he praises great effort, part of the subtlety and non-dual practice is, by its very nature, effortless. The effort to do something is a little bit dualistic in terms of there's me making an effort towards something. There's, of course, subtlety here, like effort without desire, Dogen talks about. Just wholehearted expression. Without going anywhere, without not aimed anywhere, I think that's promoted by Dogen. But Kazan makes it sound like you're a little bit like you're going somewhere. Although if you said that to him, he'd probably say, "Oh, no, I would never say such a thing." But you can tell that maybe the difference in style.
Mm-hmm. Is it the difference between sudden and gradual and Dogen's?
Well, I think in a way all of Zen, after the sixth ancestor, strictly speaking, is said to be like the sudden school, meaning like Buddha is imminent right here in one moment, and sometimes it's talked about sudden realization and gradual practice is a way of combining them. And so even though within the sudden school, that's basic, that all of Zen is, I think it's true that we can see variations on emphasizing more of the sudden or immediate. Maybe I like to translate it as immediate, because sudden makes it sound like suddenly something's going to happen. But immediate is like immediately, right now, already. This is it. I think that's what the sudden is pointing towards. Not so much a sudden experience, but like immediately, now, this. Versus gradual is like we're working up to it slowly. So yeah, within sudden, within immediacy of Zen, I think there are, yeah, maybe we could say that Keizan is a little more gradual. Yeah, I think it sounds a little bit like if you can reach this realm, then Keizan says that a lot, right? That's kind of gradual. Whereas Dogen doesn't usually talk quite like that. He's just describing the landscape of non-duality from the middle of it. Whereas Keizan may be pointing towards non-duality and saying, you must realize it soon. Soon means later. So yeah, actually. Sudden, gradual. Please.
There's this thread that keeps occurring to me, and I keep studying, beginning with your Wednesday night talk about Dhokson. And it's kind of woven through a lot of your talks, and then just looking at, so maybe this is our fourth story of the session, or fifth.
Yes, I think, yeah.
You know, what's happening between the teacher and the student, and what is the teacher doing?
Yeah.
What is the teacher doing, and what is that? How is that? It's kind of like the teacher throwing the student back on his own resources.
Mm-hmm.
One part of it, but also it's like,
yeah, stop, yeah.
Something that I can't, you know. I think that there's some commonality, something to be seen in a similar way in these stories.
Yeah.
Of the role of
the teacher. Yeah.
Sending you off, you know, sending you off to the mountain.
Yeah. I think we might say, skillful means, and it makes it sound like in these stories that there are these very particular skillful means that maybe it's easier to employ when the relationship is like really, really intimate already. Sometimes it's like they just come to the person. Sometimes they don't know the person. So sometimes it's a long relationship, and then the moment these interactions happen. But it seems something about skillfulness, and there's some an openness and trust between people to enable that. So I think sometimes I wonder is like in our culture, can this kind of thing ever happen quite like this, you know? And is it modern times? Is it
talks about the culture that's related to this is how we, I'm a teacher, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we help people learn in such a kind of, you know, the negative word would be kind of coddling way, like, don't struggle, you know, don't get stuck, I don't want you to have to be struggling here, we want to give you everything we need, and it's very...
In school. That's maybe more modern culture, maybe wasn't so much like that 100 years ago.
Well, it's also not like that in other cultures. Uh-huh. And, you know, and teachers, Japanese is very different schools there. And, you know, just in teacher trainings and in critiques of how we hold our students back, some of the methodology that's used in Japan is presented as something that we can learn from, like how we want to prevent all frustration.
Interesting.
It's just kind of related because since you've been talking about Dokusan, it's like, of course, when we come to Dokusan as students, it's like, help me here. And it seems that often the teacher's role is certainly, it's not to help in the way, it's like, just help me get unstuck.
Interesting point, about help. I read, because I was thinking about and looking into this Dokusan issue, I was kind of checking out some various modern teachers and their descriptions of that. And one person, I don't remember who, in America though, said, Dokusan is not about giving advice. I thought, wow, interesting. It's like, you know, of course, advice is helpful and good. And in that setting, I've often done. But I thought that was interesting that somebody said that. It's maybe a little bit like what you're talking about.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't see in any of these stories the master helping in a way.
In kind of practical ways.
Let me give you some.
It's true. It's true.
In the way that I'm coming with this burning question. Oh, so I'm going to tell you.
And it may be that, you know, just to leave room for that possibility that, some of these maybe are long relationships and there's a lot of that stuff happening also, and it's just these specific moments are like that. I read some of on Wednesday night, Dogen's, like Dokusan's with his teacher, and they were more like kind of discursive. He asked this kind of complicated question, and his teacher gives this long explanation about different sutras and even advice on like how you should put on your shoes, your socks before getting up from Zazen. So there is stuff like that with Dogen too, but those wouldn't go into the koan collections. I think it's a great topic to investigate. And I myself, being in this kind of role, big questions I have for like what is skillful in a setting of Dokusan and in this culture and in different settings, and maybe Sanoku Zen Center compared to a Tassajara practice period, I think I like different settings. My teacher has lots of skillful means, I think, and sometimes could be very strict with me and some of the things he'd do with me and I'd see with other people, he'd do with other people, I feel like, I don't think I could do that with, you know, if the roles were reversed, I don't think I could do it. Like, people are in tears, you know, and I can see, wow, I mean, I've seen this, not that often, but a handful of times where he really breaks somebody down and almost doesn't really even apologize. I can see that it's, from my perspective, it has sometimes looked like, wow, I think that was actually really good for that person, and they might not appreciate it right now, but maybe I hope later they can. Or it's like that's awesome that he could do that and kind of like get away with it, and I don't know, maybe it's not, maybe that's just my limited little narrow view, so maybe sometimes it's not helpful for that person. I think there were other times when I look at it, at those situations, you know, watching so many interactions with Tenzin Roshi and other people over the years, sometimes I feel like, ooh, ah, no, I don't think that was it. People get really hurt. Maybe you saw some of these events.
Well, I was just thinking about this crazy, fabulous time. I was so just scared and tight and could hardly speak. And all of a sudden, Rozzy, this dog, was under his robes, and I had no idea she was there.
In Dokusan?
In Dokusan. And all I knew...
A little dog like this.
Yeah, a Jack Russell Terrier mix, fabulous being. And this thing just propelled through the air into my arms and kissed me, you know? And how he signaled that dog, I mean, he must have used this before. I mean, they did very well. But it just like broke down the whole. I mean, I was just giggling and happy. And then Rozzy disappeared back under the road. You know, I
a team.
Oh, what a moment. Yeah.
Those skillful means.
I think that was incredibly skillful means.
But was it hit? Was it Tenzin Roshi's or Rozzy's skillful means?
That's what I was wondering. Mm-hmm.
But I mean, he had a signal, right? Rozzy didn't do this by herself.
The universe is mysterious. Yeah.
That was a good moment.
And maybe a little stupidity.
that what is it? Complete humility and complete arrogance.
Yeah,
talking about
something.
Today to even, you know, be willing to meet someone in that way as a teacher, I think it's fabulous. And,
and it's always a guess, and every teacher is different. I think Coben, for example, I think probably didn't push people too much. I would get too angry. I don't know. I just picture he was a very gentle character. Although my friend who I talked about going to his ordination, he did say near in his last few interactions with Coben, there was something, I think on the phone, where Coben was really suddenly got very kind of admonishing, and it really took my friend aback. He's like, you know, what are you doing with your life? It was really something strong. But I think that my feeling, and I think my teacher has said this, is we sometimes talk about, it's come up at like maybe San Francisco Zen Center, maybe more in like the Soto Zen Buddhist Association. People have, they're working on these standards for priests, and so on, and amongst those standards there's some people who feel like you really have to have training to like do Dokusan, to offer Dokusan is like almost like a therapist would go through training on how to do that, and like it's not just like having done a lot of Dokusans, it's really something specific, you have to get specific instructions for how to do. Some people are of that school. And others, and I think my teacher is in this other camp of like, no, just at some point you just be practicing enough and having gone to enough Dokusan yourself that you just be yourself, actually. Your role is to just be yourself and open and try to just respond skillfully to each different situation. And so I resonate a little maybe more with that because I don't know what the training would be anyway.
Completely, and really looking for that in me. And sometimes the skillful means of doing that is not pussyfooting around. It's just being really like, based on this kind of moment, and you know, whatever has come before is just it's just like, well, this is what I see right now.
Yeah.
I can tell you that. So.
And we don't want to hurt anyone. So that's.
But still, it's just I think people look for that, actually. I think people want that. I mean, yeah, there is part of them that wants the coddling and, let me help you. But I think ultimately that, you know, what you really want is just authenticity.
So it's not necessary.
Whatever form it takes.
Yeah, I think.
If you trust that person enough, yeah. To say, you know, I want you to be my teacher.
And if the person's nature is kind of very like gentle and kind of nurturing kind of nature anyway, then that's their authentic self. And if their if their nature is, I don't know, something else, then that's the case.
Challenging.
Yeah. And then I think people do maybe look between, I think someone like Reb is, some people definitely don't want to practice with him. There's a lot of, I think people tend to either like really be drawn to him or want nothing to do with him because he's kind of an intense person. And, he's very into the teaching of you just got to be yourself completely, and some people aren't going to like it, and that's okay.
But you know, it's all about breaking down this illusion of this precious self.
Yeah. But how that happens is could be very different for different people. That's where I think that's the skillful means part that I feel personally very unworthy and humbled in the face of the skillful means of these ancestors because maybe little subtle things. Sometimes you can see like there's just a natural response and it's a skillful meeting, and then other times it's like, I really don't know for this particular person. If they were me, there's this, but they're not me. like that. Yeah, it's a great topic. A lot could be explored there.
Yeah, it's a great leap. In the intimacy.
And I think you're right that it's authenticity. In the teacher role, it's about being authentic, and it's all for the sake of encouraging the authenticity of a student and everybody else. Yeah.
If you think about all the different experiences you've had with Dokusan, with a teacher, they're very different.
Yeah, very different.
And you wouldn't want them to be the same.
That's true. Yeah, exactly. That's the joy of variety. It's the spice of life. Yeah.
They would be curtailing their own capacity if they're trying to fit up.
And there's something about just meeting. And you set up that setting, and then you meet in that setting, and then there's something kind of magical just about meeting at all, ever. Like right now, there's a little bit of magic in this meeting. And it's very ordinary at the same time. But we just, that seemed like a big part of Zen is we really value meeting as well as just wholeheartedly sitting, wall gazing. So, Keizong finishes the story. Tell me briefly, how can you communicate this realm, even a little? Everyone was silent. So he said, the icy spring of the valley stream, no one peeks into it. It does not allow travelers to penetrate its depth. No one walking by the icy spring of the valley stream can see the bottom of that churning, fresh, cold water. That we swim in. May this merit equally extend to every being and place, that all may realize this realm. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.